The reading goes along with the sermon today, the sermon being a change in the law. I think you can see that in the words that were read just a little while ago. Now, in particular, and this is the first in a series on the change in the law. And I think that this idea of a change in the law is something that's fundamental and it's important. And it's probably good that we refresh our minds on this and everything. And I think back to the time when we left the whole denominational scene. And I remember the first time I read something about a difference in the covenants or laws or testaments, however you want to word it. And I was fascinated by it. And then I heard some teaching on it. I can't remember where I was at, probably at a gospel meeting, and heard a sermon on the subject. And it seemed like at that point, everything started to open up and everything started to fit in place. It was like, here's all the parts, and now you know where all the parts go. And I can remember that well. And so since that time, I've always felt like it was something that was maybe overlooked, but nevertheless, it was important. It concerns the Bible, the approach to it, and it'd be difficult to claim that differences do not exist between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Of course they do. They're numerous. Many have, though, for centuries, shifted from one to the other, from the old to the new, in order to establish customs and practices, or they've gone from the new to the old, whatever the case might be. For example, on instrumental music when we were in the Christian church, if you asked for proof or justification for it, it was always Psalm 150. And Psalm 150 has got plenty of instruments of music in there. No question about that. But it's in the Old Testament, not the New Testament. And yet that kind of got overlooked. And, well, we found something and let's just use it. And so on it goes. So it's that kind of thing. Some things in the Old Testament are welcomed. And some are not. While instrumental music might be welcomed, I think the sacrificing of animals generally isn't. And equally, some things in the New Testament are welcomed and some are not in some places. So it's fundamental in regard to what we ought to do when following God's will. In other words, where do we go and what do we use when searching? I've got up here a subtitle which is Accurately Handling the Word of Truth. That comes from the New American Standard Bible's version in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 15. Some translations have rightly dividing the word of truth. Some translations may have handling aright the word of truth. But no matter how it's worded, we understand there's a right way of doing this. It's not just that you can do whatever you want to do. And yet, when you think about this particular subject, there are several things that I think come to mind. For example, questions, valid questions. What about the Ten Commandments? Now, I'm not going to read the passages up there, but you can see them from Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 17, and Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 1 through 21. The first one is the original giving. The second is where there was a rehearsal of the history of Israel, including the Ten Commandments, before they crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land. But what about the Ten Commandments? You know, they're in the Old Testament, aren't they? There are lots of people today, they want to go back to the Old Testament. And they'll say, oh, here's the Ten Commandments, you know, and we live by them. I've heard that lots of times. All right, well, what about that? And as the study goes along, I think you'll see the answer to this question as well as the others here. How about this one? What about feast days? It's several times in the Old Testament, but in Exodus chapter 23, verse 14 and 17, there are three feast days. And not only are there three of these major feast days. Now, there were others, but these were the major ones. There was the Passover, Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, and then the Feast of Tabernacle, or Ingathering. Those were the big ones. Now, the adult males of Israel were required to go to Jerusalem for these feast days. When was the last time you went there for one of those feast days? Well, I don't think any of us have we? No. But you know what? Well, we don't follow that part of the Old Testament, but we'll follow that other one up there. Well, why? Why is that? Well, again, you know, go back and get this and not the other and so on. But what about those feast days? You know, it seemed to me like it was valid in the Old Testament. It's what God wanted. Well, why aren't we doing that? How about this? What about circumcision? That goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 17, 10 through 14, a covenant that God made with Abraham and also, of course, with Abraham's descendants. But what about circumcision? And you read through the Bible that it was all spelled out as to when and who and everything involved. What about that? What about that? And some people today think that this is something that ought to be done as a religious practice. Some don't, but some really think that. Now, here's another one here. And this one has I've got a little anecdote that goes along with this one. What about dietary restrictions? Leviticus chapter 11, verse 1 through 47. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 1 through 21. Animals that are unclean and you're not supposed to eat them. Now, if it's not in that list, you can eat whatever is not in that list. And this was something that was important. God gave these instructions to Israel to keep them pure, also to keep them healthy. And a lot of the animals, they weren't exactly the cleanest animals in the whole animal kingdom. And some of them were scavenger animals and birds and reptiles and fish and other things like that. There's a reason for it. Interestingly, when we were living in Arkansas, there was a town down the road, Newport, this county seat. They had the only newspaper in the county, and it came out once a week. And there was a man that lived in Tuckerman who was supposed to be some kind of a Baptist preacher. And although the Baptists weren't too warm toward him, but he was a Baptist preacher who was kind of a Seventh-day Baptist. So he tried to follow the Old Testament as well as the New Testament, the whole thing. And he put these articles in the paper. And one of the things that he got on one day was the dietary restrictions. And he got on catfish. You know, it says you can eat fish if they've got fins and scales. A catfish has got fins, but it does not have scales. Therefore, that makes the catfish unclean. This is not a popular subject in the state of Arkansas. You know, this isn't a state. Now, and we ate catfish a lot down there. It was really good. They could really cook the catfish. Martha and I used to go to a place, and they just had houses. It was just a fish house, you know. And the big thing was to have the catfish. But anyway, I thought to myself, this isn't going to work telling these people down here, drop that catfish and back away from the table. You know, now here's the thing. It does say in the Old Testament that catfish are unclean and you shouldn't eat them. What about these dietary restrictions? Now, here's a man trying to follow them. And I wonder if he was trying to follow everything. As far as I know, they weren't sacrificing animals, but nevertheless, you know, this is where it's all at. What about things like this? See? And there's, you know, we could just stand here the rest of our time and come up with questions that are similar to this, connected to the Old Testament. Why are we doing these things? So I think you see that there is this fundamental understanding that we have to have. Now, the title of the sermon is Accurately Handling the Word of Truth, or Handling Aright the Word of Truth. The New American Standard Version has got Be diligent to present yourself approved of God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, accurately handling the word truth. So understanding about the Old Testament and the New Testament, what things we need to do and what things we don't need to do, which one's binding, which is not, that kind of thing, that's all a part of accurately handling the word truth. But now here's something, you look at this passage. You know, we've heard this passage. Now whatever translation we've heard it in, we've heard it. And we understand that it is underscoring and emphasizing in doing the right thing. But you don't have an exhortation like this unless it is possible to do the wrong thing, or that people might have been doing the wrong thing. You know why we've got speed limit signs is because people will, if we don't have them, people will just drive whatever speed they want to drive. And so here you'd be in a school zone and people would be driving down the street from the school zone at 80 miles an hour. So we've got these restrictions to control things. And the exhortations and the laws and signs, you know, it... We go up to Miller Park, Martha and I do once in a while, and there's a sign out there that says, swimming, I can't remember how the wording is, but it's not encouraged there. You ought not to swim here because of an undertow. Well, it's out there, and why is it out there? Because people have got out there and got caught in the undertow, and they've drowned. So they've got a sign up there for it. So we've got a passage like this because you know what? There's probably some difficulties attendant to this kind of thing. It infers that the word of truth can be handled incorrectly, inaccurately. And how would that be? Well, let me just suggest a few things to you. How about misquoting it? You know, I've made a kind of a hobby over the years of different Bibles and that kind of thing. And sometimes it's companies that produce Bibles. You know, companies, there's been a thousand companies that have produced the King James Version over a period of 400 years. Thousands of companies. And different things. And then every once in a while, the Crown in England would decide to reissue it. And they would go over here and they would get a printer, say, and they would approve of this printer and allow that printer that he's now that printer's the official printer publisher of the Bible in England, the Crown, you know, and you get the stamp of approval and all that kind of. Anyway. So this one time they approved one. And here it came out. Everybody was just happy, you know, we've got a brand new one and oh, it's just a big thrill. It's centuries ago, left out a word in one of the Ten Commandments, left out the word not. And lo and behold, it said, thou shalt commit adultery. Innocent, just, you know, a typo. Wow, it really makes a difference, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So misquoting, do we just say, doesn't matter? Ugh. It matters a lot. Oh, by the way, that particular Bible became unpopular. And the people, the common people, wouldn't buy it. And they called it the Wicked Bible. You understand why? Lack of education and other things. And really what it said. Anyway, so there can be misquoting. There can be misapplying. I mean, you've just missed it here. That's not what it means. That's not what it refers to. And there's all kinds of examples of that. What about this? Taken out of context. Sure. And just because somebody says something you disagree with doesn't mean it's out of context. When we were down at the Corn Festival, Mark and I one night were working the table and there's a young lady there. You could just quote the Bible to her and she said, you're taking that out of context. We didn't even say if we believed it or what it meant. And she kept telling us, yeah, that's out of context, that's out of context. And the reason she was saying that, because we were telling her passages that didn't go in with her thinking. So it must be out of context. Well, and I wonder if there's not a lot of people that aren't like that, you know, even even people that maybe attend Bible study in church all the time. Well, anyway, but it's possible for that kind of thing to happen, deliberately or not. How about applying commands that are not germane? How about that? Paul told Timothy to bring me the parchments and bring my cloak. Are you or I supposed to take parchments and a cloak to someone? Are we supposed to do that? I see where Paul was told to go into Macedonia. Are we supposed to go to Macedonia? You get the idea. Some things are not germane. Now, what else do we need to consider while we're on this subject? Well, the Bible is not some smorgasbord. That's an old word, or it's been replaced by buffet of late, where one can pick and choose what they will and accept that as the truth of God. You know how it is. You go to a smorgasbord buffet. You go down through there, and I'll take that, and I don't want that, and I'll take that, and I don't want that. I pass up the Brussels sprouts every time. But, you know, there's other things, and, you know, people like this. They don't like... But, you know, people go through the Bible like that. That's exactly what they do. They'll take something they like, and here's, well, I don't like that, so I'm not going to accept that. I just won't. Had the lady I was talking to about baptism, and had her read it out of her Bible, and she got to the part where it said, baptism doth also now save us, and she wouldn't, she got, baptism doth also now, and she stopped there, and she said, that's it. I don't care what it says. I'm not going to believe it. I thought, I don't guess you will. Revelation chapter 22, verses 18 and 19, I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues which are written in this book. If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away his part from the tree of life and from the holy city which are written in this book. You can't go through there and just pick and choose. I'll take this, I'm not going to take that, I'll take that out. Now someone will come along and they'll say, well, those passages right there, that's just referring to the book of Revelation. Okay, and what's your point? It's just Revelation. So the rest of the Bible, we can just take parts of it and add to it and not add and take things. The rest of it, is that how it works? Is that what you're saying? No, you know, that's not what I'm saying. Well, then, you know, it's a principle that applies to all the Bible. It did back in the Old Testament. It does New Testament. It's very valid. Now, here's another thing. If someone goes back to the Old Testament, look at Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, verse 3. If one goes back to the Old Testament and picks something to follow, it's a melody of music. Well, then they must follow all. In verse 3, Galatians 5, I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. Now, keeping the circumcision like the circumcision of the Old Testament, not as a matter of health and hygiene, but as the Old Testament and a sign of the covenant for males of a certain age in Israel. If you go back and do this, well, then you're under obligation to keep it all. Well, it seems pretty simple, doesn't it? And this was a real issue in Paul's day. But it's a real issue today. Maybe not over the subject of circumcision, but other things. The application of this would be, for example, go back for instruments of music and worship. Well, back there to Psalm 150. Well, then you got to do it all. What about this? You go back for a priesthood type hierarchy. Is that anywhere in the religious world today? In Christianity? A priesthood type hierarchy? Yeah. In more places than we might think. In a lot of the denominational world, the independent denomination, not just one now, but a lot of them. Well, if you go back there and pick that up, you know, you got to do it all. The New Testament has a priesthood different from the Old Testament. We'll get to that later on. And how about this? You go back to the Ten Commandments, well, then, you know, you're still like the others. You know, you do them all. So these are things that we need to consider, and as we go along with the lessons, I think it'll all become clear and it'll all fall in place. Did you notice in the reading? In the reading, we're going to make a new covenant. And he says, and this is clear, not the one I made with your fathers in the mountain. There's no other way of understanding that. In the mountain was Mount Sinai, when Moses was up there, and God gave the Ten Commandments. And he says it's going to be a new covenant, not that one. I don't know how in the world you can read that and not see it. But multiplied millions of people do. I think it's a fact that's interesting, intriguing, amazing, fascinating, all kinds of words like that. Anyway, now let's go back to a basic point. Why have a law? Israel had a law. Now we're going to find out that we have a law today as well. Well, they had what's commonly called the law of Moses. We have today what's called the law of Christ, which is the gospel. And we'll get to that as time goes on in more teaching on this. But why have a law? Well, Israel had one, didn't they? How about Galatians chapter 3? Now go there, and it's explained for us very clearly in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 19 that the law, it says here, I put down 19, I don't think that's not right. Just a second here, and I'll find it. Yeah, that's because I'm looking at chapter. If I look at the right chapter, I'd be all right. All right, chapter 3, verse 19. Why the law then? See the question? Valid question. Well, it was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator until the seed, that would be Christ, would come to whom the promise had been made. Now, this is an argument that's made here, and it's continued throughout Galatians, throughout this chapter. But let's set aside the idea that it came through a mediator and angel. Let's set aside all that. The why of a law, it says, it was added because of transgressions. So, the law was given because of sin. That's right. And it was necessary that the law would be given because one of the things that the law would do, it would identify sin. It'd tell you what sin is. Now we'd say, well, it's transgression of law. Well, that's right. That's exactly right. But in Romans chapter 3, verse 20, you see it up there, because by the works of the law no flesh will be justified in his sight, for through the law comes the knowledge of sin. Someone says, I don't know what sin is. Look in the Bible and you'll find out. Old Testament, New Testament, look in the Bible and you'll find out what sin is. Now Paul, in Romans chapter 7, and verse 7 has this to say. And he says, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? Well, of course, the answer is no. God forbid. On the contrary, I would have not come to know sin except through the law. All right, there we go. Because the law identified sin. And here, I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, you shall not covet. And the law said, you will not steal. And the law said, you will not kill. And all those other things. See. So the law identified sin. And whatever law you're under, that's what it does. Even in the secular sense, that's what it does. Now here's another thing. The law was given in order to control sin. So the first thing it does, it identifies sin. The second thing that it does, and equally important, is that the law identifies sin. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. Realizing the fact that the law is not made for a righteous person. Who's it made for then? What's made for the unrighteous person? What would we call the unrighteous person? Probably a sinner, right? So that's who the law is made for. And he goes on. It's for those who are lawless, rebellious, ungodly, and sinners. There we go. For the unholy and profane, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, fornicators, homosexuals, kidnappers, liars, perjurers, whatever else is contrary to sound teaching. It was given to control all of these things. That there were unrighteous people. You don't have to much worry about people that are, you know, obeying the law. You know, we have a police officer that several days a week for a little period of time sits out here in the parking lot, watches the road, and it needs to. Then sometimes we've got one down here at this little pull-off, you know, at the end of the Annex Road for Highway 10. There'll be one sitting in there sometimes. He'll sit in there for a while. And then even further down the road, at about where the last field is at, there's a guy that pulls off in the bushes there once in a while, and he'll sit there. And another one on the side road where he can get in behind those little pine trees. If you're coming this way, I know where they're all at, see? Now, why are they in there? Because they're in there, they're going to nail the guy that's driving 35 miles an hour down the road out here, right? They're going to swoop out there and they're going to pull him over. Why? No. You know who they're going to pull over out there, don't you? They're going to pull over the one that's doing more than 35. I think if they just sit out here all the time, you know, you'd have, it would just be a full-time job. I mean, this is really a racetrack out here sometimes. But that's who the law is for. It's to control the people who are breaking the law. Yeah, the law was given for those sinners who are breaking the law, to rein them back, to get them to stop, to practice self-control. We're telling you what it is. And the reason we're telling you that this is what sin is so that you'll stop doing it. Why can't we understand that that's the motive about everything? That's the motive about praying for someone who's involved in sin. That's the motive behind a congregation that may have members who have fallen away or fallen into sin, and we try to administer a little discipline. Well, they're just being mean. They're just throwing them out of church. No, we're trying to pull them back in. Pull them away from what's been taking them out of duty or whatever the case might be, to get them to stop, to control the situation. That's what it's all about. And if it's for other things, well, then if it's for some other reason, well, then it's wrong. But that's why all this takes place. And indeed, that's why we've got the gospel, for the same reason the gospel identifies sin for us. And the gospel has it. You ever notice that the gospel talks a lot about self-control? In the old version of the King James, it's called temperance, or being temperate. That's the old meaning. That's the old word that was used. But now in newer translations, it's got self-control. Who doesn't understand what self-control is? And all these things that Jesus and the apostles have taught are for self-control. To pull everybody back. To get everybody doing what they ought to be doing. The whole thing is. Now the role of the law served a vital function. Sometimes people say, sometimes a member of the church, I can remember being in a Bible study one time, one place I was preaching in Indiana. And one man started making comments about the law. And when he was done, apparently he thought the law was a mistake and it was a terrible thing and that nobody could follow it at any time. And it wasn't the problem that nobody could follow. The problem was nobody did. And he just went on and on about it, and I thought, wow, you know, where'd all this come from? Wasn't anybody there that, you know, that day that thought otherwise, I guess. I talked to him afterwards, and then I preached on the subject later, trying to get across, you know, that the law had a vital function. And it did exactly what it was supposed to do. It wasn't supposed to do everything, but it did exactly what it was supposed to do. Well, what was it that it was supposed to do? Here we go. Galatians chapter 3 again. And we're going to start with verse 23. Galatians chapter 3, verse 23. Before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. Therefore, the law has become our tutor to lead us to Christ so that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. Now that's the New American Standard Bible. In verse 24, instead of to lead us to Christ, it might have to bring us to Christ. And some translations will have tutor, some will have a schoolmaster. There's a couple of translations that have the word guardian in here. Now, all these different words tell me one thing. When I see something like this, the light goes on in here for me. And when you see this difference of so many words, you begin to think, that might not be the easiest word in the world to translate. So they're making attempts to get the job done. But anyway, there's the function. To lead or bring us to Christ. That's what the law was for. And it did that. But the descriptive word in there, the schoolmaster, tutor, guardian or other, it comes from a Greek word, which is I had to rehearse this. Paidagogos, and that's the only time I'm saying that. Our English word pedagogue, which is hardly ever used anymore, actually comes directly from this word. And so it is variously translated: schoolmaster, King James Version. Tutor, American Standard Version, New American Standard Bible, the New King James Version, and in the English Standard Version, it's guardian. It's also guardian in the Revised Standard. And interestingly, in the New International Version, they just leave it out altogether. they've changed the wording in there that this fella just disappears. Anyway, Mr. Thayer, in his lexicon, has got the longest explanation of this word. And I think the best explanation, there it is up there. He says it's a tutor, or more, a guardian. And in his day, a tutor would have been a different thing. Our day, a tutor was just a teacher. Somebody that helps somebody who's having a problem with math. But it meant a whole lot more 100 years ago. But it was a guardian and guide of boys. Among the Greeks and the Romans, the name was applied to trustworthy slaves who were charged with the duty of supervising the life and morals of boys belonging to the better class. The boys were not allowed so much as to step out of the house without them before arriving at the age of manhood. And I always thought that maybe a better word would be like the old English practice of a governor. Maybe that kind of thing. But even then, you know, that not without its problems. But the guardian might be the best. But schoolmaster or tutor implies that this is the person that was doing the teaching. And that's not true. This individual was taking them to the teacher. He was the one that made sure that they got ready, that they got dressed, that they got whatever they needed, and then he led them over to where they would be taught, and when he got them there, he left them there to be taught. He didn't do the teaching. And then he'd take them back home. That's the picture of what was going on. Now, I've got a chart here. Here's the charge. All right, that's the children, the young boys. And then there's the guardian or the pedagogue. There he is. He's taking them, see? He's leading them. Well, now, in the picture there in Galatians 3, who's he taking them to? Well, doesn't it tell us that he was there to lead them to Christ? That's what the law did. And did it do that? Yeah, it did. But then it also says that when faith comes, or when it gets them to Christ and faith comes, you know what? You don't need him anymore. He steps out of the way. His job was done. Job well done. So he's not the teacher. He brought them to the teacher. Now here's the other thing. If we could just think about this for a moment or two and think about a New Testament similarity, could I suggest this? That there's the charge and there's the guardian. And the guardian is the gospel today that brings people to Christ. See? So there's some similarity. I wouldn't stretch that very far, but I think you can see the similarity in that. So the law's role here was preparatory. And it's no longer necessary once Christ or faith has come, and that's what it says in Galatians chapter 3. Now, one more point. The place of the law today. What do we do about it? What do we do with it? It's in there, isn't it? It's in your Bibles. If you've got a whole Bible with the Old Testament, New Testament, the Old Testament's in there, the law's in there. What do you do with it? Okay, let me just have a little extra something here. Back where we're from, there were people, an older generation, but there were people back there that didn't carry Old Testaments with them. They'd come to church for Bible study. They'd come, you know, for worship, and all they would bring was a New Testament, a small one or a big one. That's all they would bring. And Bible class, it had to be the New Testament. And they'd go on. And if you ask, you know, after a while when you saw this, you thought to yourself, what's going on? At least I did. I wasn't accustomed to that. I wasn't raised in that kind of culture. Well, why are we doing that? Because we're a New Testament church. And it almost got to the point that, well, we don't study the Old Testament. We don't want to know about it. And almost to the point of saying, we got no use for it. And I used to think to myself, how sad. How sad, you know, for anyone, whether it's one person or five, it doesn't matter how many, to adopt that kind of an attitude is a terrible thing. And not only is it a terrible thing, it flies in the face of what's said in that very New Testament. Turn to Romans chapter 15. Excuse me. Romans chapter 15. I'm surprised I got this far without a coughing fit. Romans chapter 15, verse 4. Now, the place of the law today is for our instruction. Whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, for our learning, for our instruction. And it goes on to say that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. The Scriptures, that's the Old Testament, for our learning. That's what was given. So it's for our instruction. Okay, it can teach us some things. That's right. And how about 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11? 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. Now, in describing in verses 1 through 10, some of the things that happened in the Old Testament time period, he says here, now these things that happened back in the Old Testament here, to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the age have come. So they were examples for us. Now, I don't have it here on the screen, but let me just suggest to you Hebrews chapter 11, too. Hebrews chapter 11's got all those Old Testament worthies. Not a New Testament name in there. All Old Testament worthies. Moses, Samuel, Noah, and the list goes on. And it says of all these that they did things by faith. God commanded Noah to build an ark. How's yours coming along? Oh, I'm not building one. Really? He commanded it. Oh, well, doesn't apply. Right. But we can see how this would take faith on Noah's part to do this. Abraham was told to leave Ur of the Chaldees. Ever been there? Probably your answer is no. Doesn't exist anymore. But you think about what he had to do at that point in history to leave that place and to travel the route that they would travel, a big arcing route, to get over to a land that he wouldn't even receive for an inheritance. Take faith? Yeah. There's your example, see? So the Old Testament serves in this way for us. But when it comes down to telling us what to do and how to do it and other things like that, well, we turn to the New Testament, that kind of thing. Now, this is the last thing we're going to look at. So you might get your songbooks and get those ready. But I want us to consider something that's said in Luke. Luke chapter 6. Verses 46 through 49. Luke chapter 6, 46 through 49. Now Jesus starts off by asking a question. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not what I say? I think to myself, you call me Lord, and yet you want to follow Moses or one of the prophets. But you call me Lord, you'll be doing the things I say. Remember on the Mount of Transfiguration? There stood Jesus, and there stood Moses, and there stood Elijah. Moses represented the law, and Elijah represented the prophets. And what did that voice from heaven say? It said, this is my beloved sons. Follow them, all of them. No, it didn't say that. I said, this is my beloved son. Hear ye him. In other words, hear ye him and follow him. Why don't you do what I say? What an important question that is. And he goes on. He says, everyone who comes to me and hears my words and acts on them, I will show him whom he is like. He's like a man building a house, who dug deep and laid a foundation on the rock, and when a flood occurred, the torrent burst against that house and could not shake it because it had been well built. But the one who has heard and has not acted accordingly is like a man who built a house on the ground without any foundation, and the torrent burst against it, and immediately it collapsed, and the ruin of that house was great. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? If you follow what I say, you'll stand secure. But if you don't, you won't stand at all. And here's the other thing. At the end of the Great Commission in Matthew chapter 28, the very last verse, verse 20, Jesus said that after you go out into the world and you make these disciples and you see that these folks are baptized, what do you do? Then you teach them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I'm with you always. He didn't tell them to go out there and to follow, you know, the prophets or follow the law or follow Moses, all good men, all who did exactly what they were supposed to do and did everything that the law was supposed to do. He said, you teach them to observe all things that I have commanded you. That's the good, and that's the proper thing. So the lesson is yours, and now the time of invitation. Back in the Old Testament, one became a child of God by the happenstance of birth. Sometimes there were those who were proselytized and became Jews, but that wasn't very often. The Jewish system was not evangelistic. They did not try to convert people to become Jews, something somebody just pretty well took on their own. And yet we realize that that's certainly not the case in the New Testament. In the New Testament time, there was the gospel, and people needed to hear the gospel. They needed to hear the gospel so that they would be able to believe it. And if they believed it, they would believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And believing that particular point, they would be willing to do what the Lord said. Why don't you do? If you call me Lord, do what I say to do. What would you have me do, Lord? And the Lord says, repent or you will all likewise perish. Confess me before men, I'll confess you before the Father in heaven. And Jesus said that he that believes and is baptized will be saved. Would you do that today? That's what the New Testament says needs to be done to become a child of God today. Quite the difference from what it was in the Old Testament, isn't it? And in the Old Testament, that being a child of God was only available to Israel, really. And all those commandments and everything about the law was given just to Israel. But today, the gospel is for all. Not just one certain people, but for all people. And if you believe it, you ought to obey it. And now's the time, and now's the place. If you're subject, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.